Over the past 3 years, American writer Ben Ehrenreich has been traveling to and living in the West Bank, staying with Palestinian families in its largest cities and its smallest villages. Eventually, he moved to Ramallah and started writing what would become his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. Ehrenreich was moved by the injustices that he witnessed and by the general silence about them in most U.S. media. As well informed as he was on the Arab-Israeli conflict, he nonetheless was consistently shocked by what he saw and by how little the vast majority of people in the United States, and even in Israel, just a few miles away, understood about the real realities of the occupation. He felt strongly that he wanted to write a book to break through many of those silences. In cities and small villages alike, men and women, young and old, they shared their stories with Ehrenreich and made their own case for resistance and resilience in the face of life under occupation. Again, the name of the book is The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. And it's a pleasure to welcome Ben Ehrenreich to the roundtable this morning. Ben, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. I read a little bit in the introduction about this, of how you came to this project, but at what point did you realize that this was sort of, for want of a better term, taking over your life?
Oh, God. Certainly by my third trip to the West Bank. I went there for the first time in 2011 to do a piece for Harper's Magazine, and then went back. That piece was about the role of water in the occupation of the West Bank. And while I was reporting that, I heard about this village called Nabi Saleh, which was having weekly demonstrations to protest the confiscation of a spring that had been taken from them by their neighboring Israeli settlement. And I went to that village just once, and it was just sort of enough to get me curious. I ended up pitching a story to send myself back to Nabi Saleh that the New York Times Magazine later assigned me. And to do that story, I went twice. I went first in the summer of 2012. Probably by the end of that trip, it had gotten under my skin. And certainly by the time they sent me back again in January of 2013, I knew that it was a place that I wanted to spend a lot more time and to really figure out.
Talk a little bit about the New York Times cover story, because that certainly created waves when it was first published. What was it about the story that you wanted to tell in that piece that you think struck a chord with so many people, including yourself?
I think the reason that it did make waves, as you put it, is that it wasn't a perspective that Americans were used to hearing. The piece, in that article, I did interview settlers. I interviewed Israeli, military and political officials. But the vast majority of the piece was written about the realities of life under occupation as experienced by Palestinians in that village. And as much as we hear, you'll often hear people complain that this is the most overreported conflict in the world, that we never hear anything about what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But, if somebody throws a rock at a settler's car in the West Bank, it makes the papers. But for all of the coverage that we get of Israel-Palestine, we very, very rarely read or hear anything that tries to account for the realities of life under occupation, that tries to take seriously Palestinian perspectives. And I think that's what both made some people very angry about that piece, and it's also what made a lot of other people, quite excited to read a perspective that they simply weren't getting in the mainstream media.
Do you believe that given the conflict over the issue as a whole, that there will always be a certain segment of the population who will not be able to read a story like that, telling about real people and their concerns, that won't make them angry in one way or another?
Yeah, I'm sure, and I everyone who writes about this knows going into it that they're not going to make, you don't write about this if you just want to make friends. that there's probably no issue, certainly no foreign policy issue, that Americans have such deeply held convictions about. There's no issue that Americans are so certain that they know everything about and are so unbudgeable in their opinions about on both sides. And, you know, I think part of that is that we actually don't get a lot of real information. You know, we do get a lot of information from the Israeli side, but you really have to search as an American for news from the Palestinian side. You have to want to find it. And it was that imbalance that I really wanted to help to correct, you know, because the results are very real. The results, I think, is that a lot of Americans have no understanding of Palestinians as human beings, and therefore are able to accept Palestinian deaths, which unfortunately come very frequently and in great number, with very little qualms. So I think the ignorance which is sort of imposed on us by the mainstream media has very real effects in terms of, you know, has life and death effects for Palestinians.
You spoke a moment ago about how this got under your skin, and how much did you know going in? I mean, how much were you unaware of much of what you're talking about that you feel so many of us are unaware of?
You know, I think I knew as much as it was possible, or nearly as much as it was possible for a well-informed American to know. You know, I had read a lot of books. I read, you know, everything I could read in the media. I understood the basic histories behind the situation. I understood, you know, most of the sort of abstract forces at play. That said, when I got there, I was blown away by what I saw. And I think a lot of Americans and foreigners who visit the West Bank for the first time have a similar experience. I've certainly seen it happen to other people, where as much as you think you understand it, you get there and are just have a hard time digesting how suddenly clear the situation is. You know, it's very easy from here. You know, if you hear people say one thing about that conflict all the time, they say, well, it's very complicated. And it is very complicated. The histories are completely tangled. But when you get there, certain things are shockingly clear to you. And the main thing is the vast imbalance of power. You know, that the Israeli military is has imposed a you know, absolutely stifling and oppressive and humiliating system, which affects all aspects of Palestinian life, and that's immediately apparent. So there, I think going there gives anyone with open eyes and an open mind a very sudden and very disturbing moral clarity about the situation, which it's pretty hard to achieve from this distance.
The book, and I mentioned this in the introduction, you do focus on these very small communities, some of them small towns just 25 minutes from Ramallah, northwest of Ramallah. And how do you see and hear those voices? What is different about those voices than when you move to larger places? Are they consistent?
You know, different places are, you know, the West Bank is quite small. You know, it's smaller than a lot of, you know, counties in the Western U.S. Despite that, there is enormous regional difference between, you know, a city in the north like Jenin or Nablus and a city in the south like Hebron or a small village in the South Hebron Hills. You know, there are very specific concerns and, you know, histories to all of those places. But for the most part, I would say people have a fairly common understanding of the occupation. You know, I think probably Ramallah is more insulated from the realities of the occupation than anywhere else in the West Bank. But I think I think people fairly universally do have a common sense of what the occupation is and how it functions, because it affects them all. It affects, you know, where they can travel, not only whether they can travel into Israel, but where they can travel within the West Bank. Sometimes people can't leave their village. Sometimes people can't leave their homes because of the restrictions put in place by the Israeli authorities. It affects, you know, where they can work, where they can study, who they can marry, you know, more or less every aspect of Palestinian life. So whatever the regional differences are, I think the occupation has imposed a kind of homogeneous system of oppression, which unfortunately everyone has to suffer and become familiar with.
And in that familiarization, you do see, and you talk about this quite a bit in the book, that it certainly isn't the only emotion, but there is a great sense of resignation. You hear over and over the phrase, "This is our lives."
Yeah, and you know, and sometimes that resignation is accompanied with a fierce determination to resist. Sometimes it's not, but you know, I think there are things which Palestinians have had to accept as normal, which you know Americans would be absolutely outraged by if they happened just once, and people have to sort of acclimate themselves to those realities in order to to live a life.
Is there ever a sense of a real sense and a real optimism of eliminating the sides of this argument and reaching an actual peaceful accord? It doesn't seem like anyone in the book, there are very few voices that feel that is immediately possible, certainly, and something that they will see in their lifetime.
I don't think I don't think anyone thinks that it's something they will immediately see. I think certainly after the last couple of generations of struggle, which dating back to the beginnings of the first Intifada in the late 1980s, I think people at that time did think it was possible they were going to throw off the occupation in their lifetimes, see the goals which they'd set out. I don't think at this point anybody imagines that's going to happen quickly or easily. At the moment, things are probably worse than they've ever been, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. And I tend, if I want to look for hope somewhere, it's not there, it's here. Because I think the stranglehold on the media discourse and the political discourse in this country on the issue is finally shifting. And it's now possible to say things, on public radio, for instance, that I think even a few years ago it would have been hard to say.
Right.
And I think Americans are really ready and hungry for a more far-reaching and more informed conversation on these issues. And I think if that happens, then one thing that will almost certainly happen, which I think is the one thing that has to happen for things to shift there, is that Israel can't count on the U.S. for absolutely unwavering support no matter what they do. And that's what they've been able to count on, and it's meant that there have been no consequences for anything the Israeli military and the Israeli government have done in the West Bank and Gaza. The U.S. has can put enormous pressure on them. We give them $3.1 billion a year of military aid, and that is quite a bit of leverage, which we are not and have not been using.
The name of the book is The Way to the Spring. Ben Ararek, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.